Throughout most of human history, food was both scarce and difficult to obtain. Not so much anymore. Our supermarkets are now stocked to the ceiling with easy-to-reach food. In fact, there is now so much food available, we have come to take it for granted. But not today, because today we are going to meet the people who make it possible for us to take all that food for granted. We'll ask them, how do you provide us with all this food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1338th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. This is the part two, the second part of a serendipitous stroll through the world of ag and vis-a-vis the World of Ag Expo in Tulare, California. So why do we call it a serendipitous stroll very quickly? Imagine you've been invited to a banquet in which you will find 1,200 delicious foods to eat. And yes, they did send you a menu so that you can plan your way through the eating. After all, you can't eat everything. So you want to find the best foods to eat in the least amount of time. And so you stared at the menu until your vision blurred and your stomach turned. Then you knew that you just had to trust to serendipity in order to get the most from this great eating adventure. And that's what the World Ag Expo was and is. A great adventure in meeting the people who grow our food. Not going to meet all of them. Why? Well, because there are 1,200 exhibitors at the World Ag Expo, over 2.6 million square feet of exhibit space, over 108,000 people with whom to bump butts with on the exhibit floors. That's a lot of people. And so to prepare for our day at the World Ag Expo, we studied the menu of exhibitors for those we thought who would be the good representatives of the world of agriculture, people who could teach us a thing or two. And then we determined to just stroll and meet whoever we thought might have something to teach us. So on our first segment of our serendipitous stroll through the world of agriculture at the World Ag Expo, we met Charlie Pitigliano, who started farming with 275 acres in 1975, and who now farms 11,000 acres of the most productive farmland in the world. Think of what we could learn if we could sit down with him for a day or two with a microphone. Ooh, that would be a great presentation. We also met the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, who is flying the flag in Washington, D.C. for the other California, the one where people earn a living by growing our food. We met Jennifer Fox. Jennifer is responsible for selling the world on traveling to Tulare, California, to take in the World Ag Expo. Jennifer Fox. We met Paul Mikesell, who built a weed-eating machine that uses artificial intelligence to identify unwanted plants and then zaps them at their meristems so they will never be unwanted again. Just get rid of plants without having to hoe them. Can you imagine that? We met Sharon Zeller and Sheila Bowen, who are women of California's agriculture and who are unashamed of their roles in holding together the nuclear farm family. We met Steve Vasquez, whose farmers turn that superabundant California sunshine into the super delicious sun-made raisins we have all found in those little red boxes. And we met Will Van Tassel, who knows how to get the money it takes to turn land into productive farmland. We met Mike Crusette, whose company brings you and me those uber-delicious and nutritious pistachios that we simply can't stop eating. And we met the boys from Northern Ireland, who traveled clear across the world to sell California dairy farmers on the efficacy of Northern Ireland knickers. Fun people. Who will we meet on the second segment of our serendipitous stroll through the world of agriculture at the World Ag Expo? Well, let's start strolling and see. We begin by taking a look at the soil. And why? Because we believe that it all starts in the soil. You know, way back in 1826, a French writer named Savarin coined the expression, "You are what you eat." His thought is now pretty much accepted by all as fact. You hear it all the time, right? You are what you eat. Well, we are what we eat, but that is not the end of the story, and certainly not even the beginning of the story. We are also what our food eats. Think about it. If you eat an apple, you are in fact eating what the apple tree itself ate. If you were to follow that thought all the way back to the beginning, you would find yourself looking deep into the life of the soil, where everything seems to be eating everything. And if those tiny soil organisms are not eating and making available the nutrients our bodies require, our bodies will suffer the consequence of deficiency diseases. And as we all know, there are a lot of nutrient deficiency diseases to deal with. And so please bear that thought in mind as we go to speak with a Vermi rancher. What is a Vermi rancher?
George Hahn, our company is California Vermiculture. We have the largest earthworm castings production facility probably in the world.
How many worms?
Our worm beds are 8 foot wide, and on 100 acres we have 15 miles of beds.
More than a few.
Yeah, there's in the healthy beds, there's 1,000 worms per square foot. So you can do 15 miles by 8 by 1,000.
Now, how do you make worm castings?
You feed the worms, and the worm castings is a polite way to say worm poop.
Right. If worms are what they eat, what do they eat?
The worms can eat anything that's been alive before. And then what we found is if you feed them the right food, most people feed animal manures, that doesn't do it. You feed the right food, you get real benefits because now you're increasing the recycling biology, which is what feeds the plants. So recycling chitin-eating bacteria and cellulose-eating bacteria will eat the biology that's in the soil and feed the plants. If you go to the redwood forest, there's no bags of 10-10-10 behind the trees, but they're beautiful, in some cases 300-foot tall trees. How did they get the nutrition to get there? They got that through earthworms that put the biology in the castings and put it in the soil.
What goes around goes up into the redwood trees, right?
Right, but it works on every plant. If you are feeding just chemical fertilizer, the only ability you have is the absorption of that chemical nutrition through the root zone, and that's for the low passage time that it goes through. Most of our agricultural soils only hold 7% moisture. Now, when you feed the worm castings and you feed the worm castings tea, you change that biological structure from sand that won't grow anything. In 3 months, you can get very healthy soil that will grow anything. The salts can go from very high, 28 decasiemens, down to very low, under 1. The moisture retention can go from 7% in 90 days to 35%. If you went from 10% to 20%, you have cut your water consumption in half.
Do you think California agriculture could benefit immensely if it all went to worm castings in the soil instead of chemical fertilizers?
Absolutely. If you replenish the nutrition delivery biology in the soil using earthworm castings, you end up needing very little, if any, chemical fertilizer, and now you're going to grow crops that are more abundant and more robust.
Good thing to do with waste from the city?
If you can divide the waste from the city, yes, you can feed it to worms. The difficulty we have in city waste is so much of it is very much contaminated. But if we could divide it, yes, we could feed it to earthworms.
Well, if only we could, that would be very interesting. But we have not been able to do that because in the city we make a lot of things that just aren't fit to feed worms. We're us when you think about it. So we have to come to grips with how do we separate it and make use of it as best we can. But it's an interesting thought, is it not, that way down there in the soil where those little organisms live, they are making the food that will be eaten by our food that will eventually work their way up the food chain to us. In their various plant and animal forms. And so when we go to the grocery store and we look at that fancy package of colorful plastic encased food, we should also give a thought to what that food ate before it's getting to our food. What did it eat? How was it nurtured? If we think about that, we'll probably be better suited to survive some of the foods that we shouldn't be eating. So moving on with soil, I have a thought about soil, land, and tenure. While walking the dog through the neighborhoods, I often try to judge whether the homes I pass are occupied by a tenant or an owner. Having been both a tenant and an owner, I know that tenants, in general, can't afford to spend a lot of time and money to keep up an owner's property. So tenants kind of do the minimum to get by on whatever the agreement, rental agreement was. And it's just the nature of time and money. So we do the minimum, and so it is manifest in how the property looks. Owners, on the other hand, have an investment at risk in the property and therefore can't really afford not to spend the time and money it takes to maintain that property. And so when you walk past an owner's home, you can look at it and it tends to be pretty well kept up. I guess you could say that I do make judgments based on appearance when it gets right down to it, which is probably not a safe thing to do these days, but, you know, when you walk down the street and you look at a house, you do make a judgment. Now, if you apply that thought to farmland and farmland's soil, you can see which farmer will be most likely to build up the soil's fertility, as our previous guest made note of, and which will be the least likely to do so. And so with that in mind, we're going to go talk with a person who's involved in farm real estate.
Yes, hello. My name is Bill Shore. I'm with California Outdoor Properties. I'm a real estate broker with 36 years experience in California.
How does one buy a farm?
Well, typically one has to have enough resources to get the financing. And of course, depending on the types of farms, there's different specialty lenders that would lend to orchard properties. Some lenders specifically focus on cattle ranches and grazing lands. Then you have others that focus on timber.
So, for example, if I was going to buy a cattle ranch, it would pay to find a broker or an agent who knew something about cattle ranches.
Yeah, well, first your lender's probably going to make sure you, the buyer, knows a little bit about the cattle business before they go out and start financing ranches to inexperienced borrowers.
Is it true that a lot of ranches are going to very wealthy people who don't know anything about buying ranches?
I would say no to that. It does happen on occasion where the wealthy purchaser from an urban environment would go purchase agricultural property, but typically there is a stock livestock producer in that area who will lease that land and keep it productive. And many California ranches are being put into the California Rangeland Trust, which preserves that property in perpetuity for agricultural uses only.
Good. Now, one of the big pieces of news current today is the Chinese are coming to buy up all the farmland.
Yeah, I see that on the news, and it is concerning to everybody. But I'll leave that to the politicians to discuss and sort that out. But right now, it is legal for non-citizens to buy land. So until our government changes those laws, we abide by them.
Now, you sell a lot of recreational property as well. How does selling recreational land differ from selling farmland or ranch land?
I don't think there is a difference. I think the only difference would be is in the buyer. The people who are buying recreational properties are not specifically interested in the production of income off that land, whereas your ag producers, it's got to produce before they'll buy it. Recreational buyers are more interested in the amenities and not so much of the income side, although the income side makes it possible for them to get financing to buy it.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Just an interesting thought. And with respect to my question is, can America find a way for new farmers to own land? If not, how can those who do not own the land build its soil for the future? We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. You know, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today, we're taking a serendipitous stroll through the World Ag Expo, looking for people who can teach us how on earth all this food gets into our supermarkets. Stacked to the ceiling it is, easy to reach, so easy to get food, we take it all for granted. Maybe we shouldn't, because who knows? So we're talking with the people who make that food available in their various roles in agriculture. 1,200 exhibitors at the World Ag Expo, over 2.3 million square feet, 108,000 people bumping butts, looking at the exhibits from all over the world, 56 countries. And with so many people there, so much money being represented, you know government's going to be there, right? So what role does government have in agriculture? Well, the annual budget for the United States Department of Agriculture alone is $30 billion. That's just the feds. There are also state departments of agriculture, county departments of agriculture, and who knows, even city departments of agriculture. There's government here, there, and everywhere. So I think the thing to do is snoop around a little bit and see what these government folks are up to.
Hi, my name's Isabel Alvarado. I'm with USDA Risk Management Agency.
Now, what does the Risk Management Agency do?
The Risk Management Agency oversees the federal crop insurance program that's available for farmers and ranchers.
Good. So when you say risk management, you're watching out to make sure that the risk is minimal?
We offer insurance. It's another risk management tool that growers have available to them.
Good. So if something happens, like a bad storm or something, there is a place for farmers to turn then?
Correct. There are different perils that are covered depending on the program, but yes, there are a lot of protections for growers.
And there are, as we have seen from the recent floods, there are a lot of things that can go wrong for a farmer during the season. People don't think about it, but city people don't think about it much. But you have all of your risk out there in the field with no protection. you can't hide it in a warehouse, or you can't, you know, stick it in a bank. It's out there growing in the field, and it's at risk from the moment you plant it to the moment you harvest it and sell it. It's always at risk. And the government does have programs to watch over that risk and help you find a way. Here's another government person to tell us what they do.
I'm Irene Padasas. I'm the Community Nutrition and Health Advisor under University of California for Tulare County, Fresno, Madera, and Kings County.
Okay. Are there a lot of hungry people around here?
Say that again.
are a lot of hungry people around here?
Oh, hungry. I mean, talking about, you know, food insecurity and nutrition insecurity, California has a lot of programs, and one of that would be CalFresh. Mm-hmm. So our program, specifically the CalFresh Education, University of California, we provide nutrition education to low-resource children, youth, families, and adults. I mean, we do a lot of lessons and classes with them related to how to manage your related to food management, physical activity, gardening, and all those things.
Lessons we can all learn.
Lessons we can all learn that having food does not necessarily mean that it's nutritious. So we need to be smart in terms of the kinds of food that we eat and the kinds of food that we serve to our families.
I guess one of the great overwhelming tragedies about the way we do agriculture now is that so many of us who work in agriculture go hungry because we can't afford the food that you buy in town. Now, my grandparents' farm, at which I was raised as a very young boy, there was always food because they had, that's principally what they grew, was people, and they grew the food that it took to grow the people. So we had all of the typical farm animals, we had a huge garden, and we had crops in the field. So there was always lots of food. Not so much anymore. So let's go quickly and talk. In the world of agriculture, we find a lot of Silicon Valley now, too. Why is Silicon Valley at the World Ag Expo? Because they have a lot of new devices that they're putting out for farmers to help them grow crops more efficiently and with less people. So let's give a listen and stick our nose into a booth and see what they have to offer here.
Hey, I'm Kent Levin with FarmX. We do end-to-end crop management, complete with satellite, drone imagery, satellite and drone imagery. We do above canopy and under canopy imagery, and we build a proprietary soil moisture probe that uses magnetic inductance to give a greater sensing volume and much more accurate than results than the capacitance probes. We also sell a fruit selector to help non-destructively test acidity and the Brix content of wine and table grapes, and we're currently expanding that to other fruits as well.
Would you explain that for the folks? You're really working. You know, one of the images, the classic images of a farmer, is somebody out in the field kneeling down and picking up a handful of dirt and looking at it and sensing what's in it. You're doing that with other things.
Sure, absolutely. And that's still a very valid methodology. But what we found is that in a lot of farms, the soil type varies greatly throughout the farm. So results in one area may not yield the same as the other area. And what our ultimate goal is to give the growers a consistent yield, right? So it's not necessarily exactly the same irrigation, but one area of your ranch or your vineyard or orchard may need more water than the other. And we use a constant feedback loop of the soil moisture probes, the imagery, and other plant health sensors such as dendrometers, infrared sensors to measure evapotranspiration to tell how your entire crop is doing, not just snapshots here and there.
So instead of being out in the field, the farmer can be in his office with his feet up on the desk, looking at his screen and knowing exactly what's going on.
You know, in an ideal world, we'd love to see that. But the reality is that we know that growers have an ever-growing checklist of items to complete. And what we'd like to do is make it so the growers can complete higher value targets on their checklist, as opposed to making sure that the valves are on or off, because we also control valves and pumps. So we have a full end-to-end solution, and we'd love to talk with you.
A full end-to-end solution, which means they develop and sell devices that can do so much of the work for you, for the farmer. Now, I once had the opportunity to interview Phil and Barbara Hamburger, who have a 25,000-acre soybean and corn farm in South Dakota. Now, their house was sitting atop a hill, and from that house you could see forever almost. But on the second floor, they had their office, and it reminded me a lot of the of a bridge on an aircraft carrier upon which I once served. Because at the bridge of the aircraft carrier, you can see all of the operations of the ship, and the Hamburger's home office, situated as it was, you could see for miles the green growth of all the crops. Incredible. Now, they had all of the equipment, which our previous guest just spoke about, to monitor everything out there in the fields for them. So instead of going out there and running down this and that and seeing if it's everything is okay, you could simply look at the instruments and instrumentation vis-a-vis their computer terminals in their office and monitor everything as they did. It was pretty incredible to see all of that technology in action. And in fact, Silicon Valley is very much involved in the business of agriculture these days. Whenever there's a farm conference in the area in which we are, the salad bowl of the world, there are lots of different businesses offering up lots of different solutions for the ag community. In our previous serendipitous stroll through agriculture, we met Mike Sell, who has developed a high-tech, I guess you call it, weeding machine. Now, I, at one time in my life, was a teenage herbicide, so which meant that you go out into the field with a sharp hoe and you chop out the weeds. Hot work in the middle of summer, the sun blazing down on you. Boy, if we could get rid of that labor, it would be something. Well, Mike Sell has done just that, he says. He developed a machine that looks like something a Martian just flew into the field and landed. And it's pulled by a tractor, and it's kind of like a big aluminum spaceship kind of thing. And it sits up above the ground, and it has these incredible strobe lights that are probing the ground, looking at the ground, and using artificial intelligence to examine each plant and examine and determine whether that plant is friend or foe. And if it is foe, it burns the plant off at the meristem, which means it isn't coming back. And so you can do this incredible weeding process that I used to do by hand, and so many people still do by hand, to get rid of the weeds. And weeds are thieves. They steal your sunshine, they steal your water, they steal your nutrients, they crowd out your friendly plants. You have to get rid of them, or they get rid of you. So the fight is on. And to have a machine that can actually tell the difference between a good plant and a bad plant is a pretty illustrative of where our technology is going. If it can do that, if it can reduce our need for labor, which is the most difficult thing to find, then we're on the way to having a successful farm. So Silicon Valley and its digital technology, which divides everything in the world into pluses or minuses, and then wraps it up in a software program, is coming to agriculture's defense. And it's going to be very interesting to see what the future brings in that regard. So we're going to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson taking you on a serendipitous walk, stroll, as it was, through the world of agriculture, vis-a-vis the World Ag Expo in Tulare, California, which recently took place. Had an occasion to spend a day there, and what a day it was. So when we come back, we're going to meet the people of pollen, and we're going to talk bees and pollen. And remember that conversation we had when we were very little about the birds and the bees and what they all make possible? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We're taking a serendipitous stroll through the world of agriculture, meeting whoever we see that looks interesting and might have something from which we can learn. And we can always learn about from the bees, and we can learn about the food we eat. Why? Because, well, one-third of the food we eat is made possible by the work of bees. To get to the World Ag Expo, I had to drive through mile upon mile of fruit and nut orchards. Each block of trees was going into blossom at the time. Oh, it was so stunning. And lining all of these orchards were white boxes filled with beehives, most of which, I think, are shipped in from Florida every year. An amazing feat when you think about it, shipping all those bees all those miles to pollinate all of those trees. Well, I wonder if there's anything we can learn from those bees that can help us understand our world of food. So I think that's where we'll go right now.
My name is David Kia. I'm with Antles Pollen in Wenatchee, Washington, in Modesto, California.
Good. And what do you do? Your sign says a pollination enhancement. Holy smokes.
Antles basically enhances pollination by supplying live pollen for various fruit and nut crops that is applied to the orchard during bloom in order to increase pollen density and pollen quality in the orchard and thereby set more fruits and nuts.
Are you trying to replace bees?
Absolutely not. We believe that it's a fool's errand to try to replace bees in pollination, but we can make the bees more efficient at what they're doing.
How do you do that?
We basically put live compatibility matched pollen in the path of the foraging bees, whether that's delivered through the beehive dispenser or a blow-on applicator. And in doing that, we load the bees up with higher quality pollen and pollen that is a better fit for the orchard, so that wherever the bees may be flying in that orchard, they're more likely to have successful pollinations.
It sounds like you're taking away a lot of the work for bees.
We don't want to make them lazy, but they can take any help they can get, I think.
Well, if you had seen the extent to which those orchards are... And the interesting thing about them, of course, is that there's just one thing out there for one kind of pollen for all of those bees to feed on. And it's the pollen of those trees. If the trees aren't in blossom, then there's really nothing for the bees to feed on. So I wonder what happens to all of those bees after they've been pollinating all of those trees. Kind of sad story to think about it. And all to add to the other sad story, which was all of the bees that gave up their lives on my windshield as I drove through the Central Valley to get to Tulare. A lot of bees ended up on my windshield. Really sad to see that because I'm a great fan of bees. So looking out into the fields, as we city people drive around, We see a lot of farmers out there working on their tractors, and I'm always on the lookout for the farmers of color because we want to see what kind of tractor they're on. So what I have is farmers of color, and I judge farmers by their color. And why do I do that? Because farmers, each farm equipment manufacturer has their own color. So we're going to start meeting these farmers of color as we go along here. And we're going to start with one you probably would recognize right off the bat. Here we go.
Yeah, I'm Greg Christensen, marketing manager for 5 Series Tractors and high-value crops for John Deere. And I'm based out of Kansas City, Kansas.
Kansas City, Kansas. Good. Now, I have to ask you, what's your favorite color?
It's obviously green. Yeah. Grew up loving green and still love green to this day.
Good. So when people are out driving in the countryside and they look out and see a tractor and a farm implement that's green, that means?
It's John Deere.
John Deere.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about John Deere now.
Yeah, I'll tell you kind of why we're specifically here is we we have a variety of solutions for a lot of different folks, whether they're having have a orchard or a vineyard, or they have a dairy operation, or just messing around on their property with a small tractor. And at our booth today, if they don't have any of this stuff and are just a fan of the brand, we brought in an 18-wheeler that they can get a hat and a shirt as well. So a little something for everyone here at the booth today.
Good. And what kind of equipment do California farmers use that are probably different than they would use in out in the heartland?
Yeah, so obviously the different types of equipment here are getting into that orchard vineyard tractor, so more specialty tractors that really fit within the row and under the canopies, different types of sprayers to spray the orchards, spray the vineyards, different types of planters where they're planting carrot seed and all the vegetables everyone finds at the supermarket. Those get planted with a Monosem planter that's part of John Deere. The stuff that all of our lettuce, tomatoes, carrots, strawberries, almonds, this is helped produce with John Deere equipment.
How long has John Deere been helping farmers grow food for America?
I mean, John Deere's been around for over 180 years. So, all starting with that steel plow in the Midwest to till the soil. Now to, every solution you see here at the booth, from tractors to planters to sprayers to hay equipment to silage equipment to hay rakes to skid steer loaders to there's a solution for any type of grower or customer.
Good. So when folks driving down out in the country and they see green, that means?
John Deere.
John Deere. Well, there you go. A fun little game as you're driving out in the country and you see the farmers out in the field working on their tractors. What color is the tractor? Because that kind of tells you who's making the equipment. And these farmers can get pretty proprietary about the color of their equipment. You have green farmers and you have red ones and you have blue ones and so on. We're going to meet a lot of them as we go along. And as a matter of fact, we're going to meet another one right now.
Hello, my name is Darcy Turtling, and I work for AGCO.
And what does AGCO sell?
AGCO sells farm equipment, agricultural equipment.
And you have red equipment and green equipment. What's the red equipment?
Red equipment is Massey Ferguson for tractors, and the green is Fendt for tractors as well.
French tractors?
No, Fendt. Oh. So Fendt is actually a German tractor.
Okay, good. So American and German tractors. Now, what would you say the difference between American and German tractors is?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for, really. Fendt is more of the luxurious tractors, and Massey Ferguson is dependable and straightforward.
I like them both.
I do as well.
Okay, lots of different tractors, red ones, blue ones, German ones, American ones, lots of different tractors. But it's not just tractors, of course. There are many other things, too. And one of the more fascinating ones had to do with trucks. And I've been around trucks all my life. My father was a machinist who worked on trucks. in growing up in Billings, Montana, along the interstate there, trucks would come through and they would break down. Machinery is always breaking down, and somebody has to be able to fix it. And my father had the skills of a machinist, and so could take parts of one truck and make them work in another part. He could cut iron. He could weld it. He could machine it. He could fine tune it. I once watched him take a truck and make it do something entirely that it was never designed to do, but made a new truck out of an old truck. And so I've been a fan of trucks. Pay attention to them. And so when I saw Peterbilt, which is a big name of trucks, I was immediately taken aback by it because it didn't have any smokestacks. Now, what I always liked watching a big truck fire up, because the engine roars to life and a big cloud of smoke comes out of the smokestacks, and it's like a dinosaur coming to life. Roar! But this truck had no pipes. And when it came to life, it didn't make a roar at all, which of course meant, is it an electric truck? Is it possible?
Hi, I'm Gary Catano with E.M. Tharp Golden State Peterbilt. I'm the sales director.
And you're selling Peterbilt trucks, world-famous Peterbilt trucks that are electric?
Correct. We have three models. We have the medium-duty 220 model, and then we have a 520, which both of those are cabovers, and then we also have the 579, which is a Class 8 vehicle, so two Class 8 trucks and one Class 6, 7.
So when folks see these big Peterbilts going down the road without smokestacks,
that would be electric.
That would be electric. Now, do you see electric trucks displacing diesel?
I believe it's inevitable at this point. Time frame-wise, we're still working on that, but it's set up to be electric. Electrified world we're going to be in.
Do you see truck stops featuring quick charges for electric trucks then? Is that going to be something we'll see?
There's actually some currently in place, and we are building out the infrastructure with fast chargers.
Okay. How long does it take to charge a big Peterbilt truck?
Depends. If it is on the lower side with a quick charger, you can have it done within a couple of hours.
So not bad, a lunch. How far will that take, that charge, take a Peterbilt pulling a full load?
It would depend on the terrain. It would depend if it's going up a hill. But on average, we're around 200 miles.
200 miles.
Yeah. Okay. But again, there's variations.
Well, what do you think, folks? Do you think the electric trucks are ready to take over agriculture? I don't think so. If it takes 4 hours to drive 200 miles and another 2.5 hours to recharge, that's 6.5 hours to drive 200 miles. That doesn't work out to be too cool. So not headed that direction yet, but it's coming, he says. It's inevitable. You know, there was a time when farmers and ranchers spoke openly about selecting the best and rejecting the rest. And from it, they have improved their herds through that selection process. Let's talk a little bit about selection.
My name is Tony Allen. I'm the general manager for Agritech Analytics in Visalia, California. Agritech Analytics is a dairy records processing center. What we do is we bring data into our facility, production data such as how many pounds of milk the cow gave, the fat content and the protein content of that milk, somatic cell content of that milk. We take that and then we get other data, which is we call status, which is when did a cow have her calf, when was a cow bred, when did they stop milking her, when did they sell her, was she sick, why was she sick, any type of incident in that animal's life. That data comes directly from the dairy. The production data comes from what we call a DHIA lab. We merge that data at our place, generate reports that go back to the dairymen, and they use those reports to manage their farm, to be more profitable, be more efficient, and remain viable in a very challenging industry.
Is this a very fancy way of saying we cull the herd?
We don't. We give them the information, and then they decide which animals they're going to cull.
Well, you know, you don't hear much talk about culling a herd these days, a kind of a culturally insensitive way of talking about things. And I know farmers who get into trouble for doing just that, for selecting the best and rejecting the rest. Well, how do you cull an animal? You set them aside, and there they are. And I recall Joel Salatin talking about having to set some of his cattle aside in a section of the pasture for culling and getting in trouble with the neighbors. But that's the way things are. You have to select. In the year 1900, the average dairy cow produced 1,800 kilograms of milk. 100 years later, the average dairy cow produces 8,500 kilograms of milk. So that's been our second serendipitous stroll through the world of agriculture. I want to thank you all for joining us, and stay tuned for stroll number three. We're going to meet the people who have the money that make agriculture so big and so powerful and so successful all over the world. The big money of agriculture. Among many other subjects that we're going to meet, interesting people teaching us as much as they can in a very short period of time about where our food comes from. This has been the Food Chain Radio. I am Michael Olson. Do stay tuned.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.